It's now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WRT's local news for Tuesday, April 23rd. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. In tonight's news, activists gathered at the state capitol calling for the abolition of solitary confinement.
A new climate-focused exhibit opens at the Madison Children's Museum.
A story of transgender solidarity is on display at the Chazen Museum of Art.
And in the second half, we consider academic freedom and DEI at UW-Madison, visit Turnkey Supper Club on Madison's east side, and lend a hand to ducklings.
All these stories and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for reports from around the world.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. A key witness at the criminal trial of Donald Trump has told the court in New York how he suppressed negative stories about the former president to help him win the 2016 election. The former publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, said he paid for exclusive rights to such stories, including one involving the porn actress Stormy Daniels, but didn't print them. Gary O'Donoghue has more on the prosecution's tactics.
What they're trying to do is establish the background here and say that David Pecker was involved really in a sort of plan with Donald Trump and his lawyer, not just to stop those negative stories about Donald Trump, but to promote positive stories before the election and indeed to promote smears about some of his opponents, Hillary Clinton, the Republican opponents like Ted Cruz. So what they're trying to say is that this was part of a pattern that led to the situation with Stormy Daniels, which of course is the subject of this particular case.
The US Senate is debating the final passage of four foreign aid bills that would send billions of dollars in military assistance to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said approving the measures would send a message to the world that the United States would always defend democracy in its hour of need. Anthony Zerka is in Washington.
There have been divisions, and that is divisions within the Republican Party among conservatives who don't want to give any more support to Ukraine, and perhaps maybe older school foreign policy hawks within the Republican ranks who are in favor of continued robust U.S. foreign aid. Joe Biden is scheduled to sign it if it passes tomorrow afternoon, and the U.S. Pentagon has said that it could only be a matter of days before this aid package starts to arrive in Ukraine.
The U.S. government says allegations that Israeli forces buried more than 300 Palestinians in a mass grave at a medical complex in Gaza are incredibly troubling. Earlier, Israel's military rejected the Palestinian accusation, calling it baseless and unfounded. Some of those buried in the medical complex in Khan Yunus were reported to have been summarily killed. University students and professors are marching in the Argentine capital to protest against cuts to public higher education. President Javier Milei approved the same university funding levels for the current year as 2023, despite inflation having reduced the real value of the budget. Ivan Massari explained why he was taking part.
Public education is a tool for social transformation. It's the opportunity for a person to be able to develop themselves, to be able to contribute to society, to be able to build their future, to really be a tool that can transform their reality and that of their environment.
BBC News. Indigenous leaders from across Brazil are gathering in the capital for the largest indigenous mobilization in the country, known as the Free Land Camp. Representatives from various villages are camping out in central Brasilia, advocating for land demarcation, recognition of fundamental rights, and an end to violence in their territories. Tesla has reported a huge fall in profits. They were down more than 50% in the first 3 months of the year, compared with the same period last year. The electric vehicle maker also registered its first year-on-year quarterly drop in revenues since 2020. Erin Delmore has more details.
It's been a rocky road for Tesla this year. Higher interest rates are taking a bite out of consumers' purchasing power and pushing big purchases out of reach. Competition with China, especially rival electric vehicle maker BYD, is heating up. Tesla has been cutting prices and announced layoffs. But investors have one bright spot to look to. The firm announced it's speeding up the launch of a lower-priced vehicle. More affordable models could be a boon for cash-strapped U.S. consumers and a hit in big competitive markets worldwide like China and India.
The Italian Parliament has passed a controversial law allowing anti-abortion activists to be present in government-funded abortion clinics. Pro-choice campaigners worry it will add to the pressures on women who are considering a termination. The Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, made the bill a confidence issue, meaning she would have been forced to resign if the vote had been lost. A 60-year-old Argentine woman has become the first contestant of her age to win the title of Miss Universe for Buenos Aires. Alejandra Rodriguez will represent the region in the final of the national competition. She says she wants to demonstrate to all women that beauty knows no age. BBC News.
This is Christian Knutson and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
Yesterday, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson told reporters that voters should see what abortion looks like at every stage of pregnancy. Johnson made his comments the same day that Vice President Kamala Harris visited La Crosse, with abortion a key issue for Democratic voters. Harris spoke on the topic at a Milwaukee rally in January, and Wisconsin Democrats have held several events where women speak out in support of abortion access, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In a recent Marquette Law School poll, 24% of Democrats list abortion as their most important issue in recent polling, while only 5% of Republican voters named it their top issue. Johnson also spoke out yesterday in support of a bill that would have set a referendum asking Wisconsin voters if abortions conducted beyond 14 weeks of pregnancy should be banned. That bill did not pass the state Senate, but if it had, the proposal potentially could have led to a ban of abortions at 14 weeks instead of the 20-week ban, which is currently in place.
Wisconsin can expect to receive some $750 million in a multi-state opioid lawsuit settlement over the next several years. But lawmakers haven't settled on how much of that money will be spent. Yesterday, Republican leadership on the state legislature's budget writing committee made it known that they object to the spending plan. They didn't cite their specific concerns, though, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. The committee has already redrafted the two previous plans submitted by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. The most recent plan targeted a large portion of the funding for prevention, along with support and first responder services for those struggling with addiction and their families. The funds come from settlements reached in nationwide lawsuits by state and local governments against pharmaceutical companies that manufacture opioid drugs. The state gets an annual payment for the settlement, with 70% of the money going to local governments and 30% going to the state. Wisconsin expects to receive $36 million in settlement payments to be spent from this July through June 2025.
Governor Tony Evers announced today that applications are now open to fill the vacated seat of retiring Dane County Circuit Court Judge Josanne Reynolds is stepping down as of July 12th of this year after nearly 10 years of service as a judge for the county. Judge Reynolds was appointed by former Governor Scott Walker in 2014 and mostly served on criminal cases, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The deadline to apply for the vacant seat is May 13th, with a selected candidate completing a term ending in July of 2025.
A Madison firefighter is on administrative leave in the wake of being accused of selling cocaine out of his own firehouse. Trevor Wiggins was charged earlier in April for four separate drug-related felony charges, including manufacturing, selling, and delivering cocaine. The Wisconsin State Journal reports the criminal complaint against Wiggins lists four separate drug purchases that investigators allege they made using money from the Dane County Narcotics Task Force from February to April of this year. Back in 2017, Wiggins was sentenced to 45 days in jail after a drunk driving incident injuring another driver.
St. Mary's Hospital in Madison is starting a program where some patients who are ready to leave the hospital can get in-home treatment typically found in nursing homes. This new program is the first phase of a new partnership between SSM Health and Minneapolis-based Inbound Health, a provider of in-home post-hospital services. According to a statement from SSM Health, eligible patients will have access to daily in-home and virtual visits from clinicians and specialists, as well as a digital tablet for remote monitoring and around-the-clock assistance. SSM Health staff believes the new services will help ease capacity issues at hospitals and nursing homes, reports the Wisconsin State Journal.
Tokyo-based Kikkoman Foods will build a $560 million soy sauce factory in the city of Jefferson on 100 acres of land the company purchased from Jefferson County, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Kikkoman has had a long-standing presence in Wisconsin since it opened a soy sauce plant in Walworth in 1973. That plant is known to be the highest-producing soy sauce facility in the world. The new plant in Jefferson will be completed in two phases. It will cover over 300,000 square feet for office, production, and warehouse spaces, and will add 90 jobs. That location will be along Industrial Avenue on the south side of Jefferson. Groundbreaking for the new facility is scheduled for June, and it's expected that the soy sauce will start shipping from the facility in the fall of 2026.
A mural on Madison Metro Transit's East Side Maintenance Building has hit yet another roadblock, sparking criticism from the artist. The city awarded artist Jenny Gao the project in November 2022, and the mural was slated for completion last year. But their contract negotiations took almost a year, as Gao had to redesign their work due to the building's ongoing renovations. Last month, just after Gao and the city agreed on a contract, the city discovered that the building's siding needs to be replaced. That will require yet another redesign. According to Gao, they have logged about 318 hours of work on the mural since the spring of 2022. The city paid Gao $2,000 in 2022 and $3,000 in 2023, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Earlier this month, the Madison Arts Commission approved paying Gao $10,000 to redesign the mural so it works with the new siding. But Gao said this latest payment would only cover the work they do in the future, and that they haven't been compensated for all the work they have done since the project started. The mural's new completion date is now set for 2026, 3 years past the original date.
Have we reached the end of the East Side Ice Cream Wars? Jaylee Magdalena, owner of a new business coming to Madison's Atwood Avenue, is hoping to smooth out the rocky road. His new ice cream shop, The Sassy Scoop, is slated to open on the corner of Atwood Avenue and Jackson Street, the site of an old neighborhood feud. For 6 years, the prominent 350-square-foot space was home to a seasonal chocolate shop location, but it was pushed out after the Davenport family bought the building and opened the Atwood Scoop. The Davenports thought the location was a sherbet, thanks to the nearby bike path and the area's high foot traffic. But the chocolate shop went on to open a year-round location just down the block, and it consistently outperformed the Atwood Scoop. Magdalena is a longtime friend of the Davenports and their new lessee, but he tells the Wisconsin State Journal that he hopes to differentiate his business, the Sassy Scoop, from the Atwood Scoop as much as possible. Magdalena plans to sell at least 18 flavors of ice cream from the Columbus-based Sassy Cow Creamery. He's currently seeking permits for the Sassy Scoop signs and hopes to open for business soon. And those were the headlines. Now on to the rest of today's top stories.
A group of faith leaders and prisoner advocates held an event today at the Wisconsin State Capitol to promote eliminating the practice of solitary confinement in prisons. WRT reporter Nate Carlin has the story.
And I think that the day will come when we do not have prolonged solitary confinement in our prisons. And we're not talking about putting lipstick in a pig, and we're not talking about building a whole bunch of new prisons and making them a little bit more comfortable. We're talking about actually ending the practice of solitary confinement in this country.
That was Reverend Ron Steef speaking today at the Solitary Confinement Day of Action held at the state capitol. The event was in support of a series of bills being put forward in the state legislature that address inhumane conditions in Wisconsin's prisons, particularly around the practice of solitary confinement. Wisconsin prisons have been suffering from low staff levels, leading to a series of extended lockdowns across the system. Four controversial prisoner deaths occurred in the last 9 months at Waupun Correctional Institution during an extended lockdown, including the death by suicide of Dean Hoffman while he was in solitary confinement. His daughter spoke at the event.
It is my belief that the reason solitary confinement exists and even persists today is because people that it impacts are not even seen as human in the first place.
Data from the Wisconsin Department of Corrections shows that an average of about 4% of the Wisconsin prison population is in solitary confinement at any given time, and the average stint is just over 50 days. Solitary confinement can have myriad adverse psychological effects, and it has been shown to increase the likelihood of premature death, even after release. At the federal level, the use of solitary confinement has come under increased scrutiny. A recent report from the Government Accountability Office found that solitary confinement was implemented in a racially disparate manner, with black inmates making up 59% of inmates in solitary confinement, despite being only 38% of the federal prison population. The report also found that the Bureau of Prisons had been slow to take up recommendations designed to promote responsible use of solitary confinement. Reporting for WORT, I'm Nate Carlin.
Now 6:17 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
The Madison Children's Museum will soon open a new exhibit as part of a nationwide movement to help kids engage with nature and better understand climate change. WORT reporter Lila Grubb has the story.
The two-year program, labeled Caretakers of Wonder, has partnered with 9 children's museums and science centers across the country, bringing along climate and child experts. The goal is to teach young children about climate change in a way that doesn't impact their mental health. Funding for the program comes from the Institute of Museum and Library Services in the form of a $339,000 grant, among other art-based grants, according to the Wisconsin State Journal. Caretakers of Wonder is also sponsored and directed by the Madison Children's Museum, which is in the process of putting together its new exhibit for the program. Titled The Nice Age Trail, this exhibit will consist of trails and activities to help children learn how to engage with nature while also teaching them how to build community. It's a play on the 1,200-mile-long Ice Age Trail, which wraps across the state of Wisconsin. I spoke with Brenda Baker, the Vice President of Exhibits and Strategic Initiatives, who shared the museum's strategy for doing so.
They're going to walk into an exhibit that has 4 seasons, and they'll also be able to take these small little trails.
There are 26 trails in the exhibit, each representing a letter from the ABCs of kindness.
When they get to the trailhead A, there'll be an activity about attention, about how paying attention is important.
While children explore the trails, there will be activities at each letter to teach them how to apply that word to real-world scenarios.
When they get to the H letter, for example, that trailhead, they'll learn about helping others. In this case, it's a beaver lodge. They're going to help beavers build the den.
The Madison Children's Museum has also had a green initiative for the last 30 years, meaning it aims to create an environmentally safe and sustainable organization for children throughout the entire museum.
We're trying to be mindful about everything, how we market, what kind of donors we work with, so that in everything we do, we're really thinking about children now and the future.
The Nice Age Trail grand opening is set for June 1st and 2nd. It'll be open year-round and included in the admission price. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Lila Grubb.
The payday lending industry has long been under scrutiny over widespread outcry about negative impacts on its consumers. Researchers are now revealing financial burdens falling on those who apply for smaller, similar loans through cash advance apps. Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
Wisconsin lawmakers recently debated reforms for payday loans. Efforts to protect consumers come amid new research about financial pain associated with cash advances offered through smartphone apps. The Center for Responsible Lending is out with findings that detail how earned wage advances from digital platforms come with extra costs disguised as things like tips. Traditional payday lenders are often criticized for charging excessive interest rates on loans that are usually around $500. The center's Lucia Constantine says customers are usually seeking smaller amounts from the apps, but she warns they can be just as costly.
They are trapping consumers in a cycle of borrowing that is similar to that of a payday loan.
The report says after using these financial products, customers are seeing overdrafts on their checking accounts increase by 56% on average. Industry leaders deny they're barraging customers with hidden fees, stressing that features like suggested tips are optional. More broadly, a bipartisan payday loan reform bill in the Wisconsin legislature failed to advance this month. Constantine says, like longstanding payday lenders, these cash advance apps can be hard to regulate. Meanwhile, she urges those in a bind to explore other options.
Try talking to their friends and family as a first source. The other option, which I would recommend, is reaching out to their credit union or banking institution to see if they can get some sort of small dollar loan.
She says places like credit unions typically provide more transparency on loan costs. According to the report, 3/4 of consumers took out at least one advance on the same day or day after a repayment was posted. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
It's now 6:21 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. What do horse girl memes, volleyball nets, and copious amounts of orange silicon all have in common? Artist Kat Burke unites these elements to tell a story of transgender solidarity in their new exhibit at the Chazen Museum of Art titled, quote, My Mother is a Horse. WORT reporter Ella Saff has more.
Your exhibit is titled My Mother is a Horse. That's a very eye-catching name. What does the title mean, and where did it come from?
So it's from that passage from that book about the Premarin medicine, estrogen derived from pregnant horses that is not used anymore, but has this sort of literal connection between horses and trans women. And it, so it comes from that book. And then, it also is, relating to the horse and the image of the horse girl, and creating or forming an identity around a found image, through that. So it's sort of double mothering.
The book Burke is referencing is Aurora Mattia's The Fifth Wound. The passage that inspired Burke addresses a rising theory in trans politics about the cliched image of the horse girl and its relation to trans girlhood. Premarin was a medication containing estrogen derived from pregnant horse urine. It was used as an early method of hormone replacement therapy. So what does your creative process look like when you're starting an exhibit like this?
Well, this is the first one, so I don't have any other sort of things to check it against, but I mean, it just starts with the idea, it starts with experimentation.
The centerpiece of Burke's exhibit takes up an entire wall, corner to corner. It is a patchwork quilt of soft orange silicone squares, which were created by brushing silicone onto other pieces of art in Burke's collection, and then peeling it off.
I was like, okay, I have to make it this big. I have to do this many to fill the wall, so I need to do it this amount of times, and you have to sort of calculate all the material that you need, and it is three coats brushed on, so it can be strong enough when you pull it off. There's like 6 hours of cure time, so I'd be able to do one in a day. And so that was just a long, like, couple months of doing that every day, very labor intensive.
There are 207 silicone reliefs of Burke's paintings on the wall. Each silicone square appears to be tacked to the wall with miniature plastic horses. The paintings in Burke's exhibit are covered in colorful squares and dots, formed by nets pulled taut over the front of the canvases. The paintings line the other walls of Burke's exhibit like so many Technicolor plant cells. I asked Burke about the significance of the repetition. Why make copy after copy of their paintings out of silicone?
So that is the sort of like thesis of the show, is thinking about how we form our identity off of, like in relationship to like images and objects. And so how like seeing ourselves in things, like me seeing myself in a horse or in like memes or whatever, factors into like how I sort of become a person or like form like an identity or personhood. So seeing something and then trying to replicate it, like, in the other sense. So like making this image, and then trying to copy it with, this actual thing.
How do you define identity, and what is it that makes up your identity?
I think that's kind of a hard question. But I think it's sort of all of the objects, images, like relationships that we sort of gather around us and like hold like within us, and how we take all of those things and like understand them sort of like emotionally or personally. And there are a lot of like categories to it, like gender, race, class, all of these things. But like broadly, or like sort of more broadly than that, I think it's really defined by, you know, what we surround ourselves with, and how we're like brought up and how much sort of agency we take over what we do and, you know, what people we keep around us and what things we like to look at.
I definitely feel like finding your identity is a very emotional process. Some of it you can create yourself, and some of it is kind of imposed on you by society.
Yeah, and I think one thing that in thinking about like identity is as a sort of as like a trans thing, and as like trans as like a sort of way of thinking and way of doing. The identity is being a thing that's really not fixed and a thing that's really sort of, we can take full control over it if we want to. Mm-hmm. Even with all of these things that are sort of put on us from outside.
The phrase T for T came up a lot in your exhibit brochure. What does that mean to you?
So that means trans for trans. What that means to me is how trans people like show up for each other, and what trans people do for each other, and how we help ourselves. Being trans is a way of like thinking about stuff. So T for T is really a way of thinking about the world. So it's just a sort of a big framework to work through a lot of things that isn't necessarily limited to like just like gender.
Burke's exhibit is difficult to adequately describe with words. There's a neon orange horse head resting in a seashell, a play on The Birth of Venus by Botticelli. There's a pink sheet of silicone folded over a cinder block, suggesting the image of a saddle. And there are a lot of little plastic horse figurines. The only way to appreciate My Mother is a Horse is to visit Burke's exhibit in the Chazen Museum before July 14th. Reporting for WORT Local News, I'm Ella Saff.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us.
We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. Cardinal Call examines the deal between the state legislature and the UW system on DEI initiatives.
Stuff Your Face chats with the manager of the Turnkey Supper Club.
And Wildlife Weekly describes all the ways that ducklings can get into trouble.
But now we'll take a quick break and check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
Literacy Network invites you to help them celebrate 50 years and toast to the next half century and free adult literacy education. From 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th at Boardman Clark, you can enjoy signature cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, and a program that features speeches from Lupita Montoto of La Movida and other supporters. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at literacynetwork.org/50thcelebration. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 21st. In addition to the event, you can also check out the silent auction, which is live now through April 25th. That's a toast to 50 years of Literacy Network at Boardman Clark, 1 South Pinckney, from 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th. You are listening to WORT Madison.
BBC News. A key witness at the criminal trial of Donald Trump has told the court in New York how he suppressed negative stories about the former president to help him win the 2016 election. The former publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, said he paid for exclusive rights to such stories but didn't print them. The US Senate is debating the final passage of four foreign aid bills that would send billions of dollars in military assistance to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said approving the measures would send a message to the world that the United States would always defend democracy in its hour of need. The US government says allegations that Israeli forces buried more than 300 Palestinians in a mass grave at a medical complex in Gaza are incredibly troubling. It said it was seeking the Israeli government's response. University students and professors are marching in the Argentine capital to protest against cuts to public higher education. President Javier Milei has recently been claiming that state-run universities are centres of socialist indoctrination to justify the cuts. Tesla has reported a huge fall in profits. They were down more than 50% in the first 3 months of the year compared with the same period last year. Italy's parliament has passed a controversial law allowing anti-abortion activists to be present in government-funded abortion clinics. Pro-choice campaigners worry it will add to the pressures on women considering a termination. A 60-year-old Argentine woman has become the first contestant of her age to win the title of Miss Universe for Buenos Aires. Alejandra Rodriguez, a lawyer and journalist, says she wants to demonstrate to all women that beauty knows no age.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us. In a recent panel discussion on the UW-Madison campus, experts considered challenges to academic freedom and the DEI deal between the Universities of Wisconsin system and state Republican lawmakers. Daily Cardinal reporter Amari Mbonwo talked with host Oliver Gerhardt about the discussion on this week's Cardinal Call.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your weekly dose of UW-Madison campus news from the Daily Cardinal student newspaper. I'm your host, Oliver Gerhardt.
On April 11th, a panel of experts held a discussion on challenges to academic freedom and the recent DEI deal in a session hosted by UW-Madison's Center for Humanities. Today, we're joined by reporter for the Daily Cardinal, Amari Mbonwo, to discuss her article on the panel and the issues covered by the panel. All right, so Amari, who were the panelists?
Yeah, so the panelists included Professor of Rhetoric and Culture, Michael Bernardolis, former UW Systems General Counsel, Patricia Brady, Professor of Philosophy, Harry Brighouse, Assistant Professor of African American Studies, Brittany Edmonds, and then Armando Ibarra, who's a professor in the School for Workers and the Department of Chicano and Latino Studies.
So who's moderating the discussion?
Ross Castronovo, who's the director of the Center for Humanities.
So what were some of the main topics of discussion at the panel?
Yeah, one of the main topics of conversation was the difference between freedom of speech and academic freedom and what that means for faculty, specifically at UW-Madison. They also talked a lot about how the recent attacks on DEI have affected like DEI initiatives on campuses nationwide and what steps we need to take in order to protect DEI and students who fall under those categories as well. And lastly, they talked a lot about the university maintaining independence from the legislation and how the university needs to decide who is it going to be accountable to? Is it going to be accountable to private interest or the public that it serves?
To start with the DEI side of things, diversity, equity, and inclusion, I wanted to ask, recently the UW system struck a deal with State Speaker Robin Voss that exchanged capital projects and pay raises for large cuts to the DEI programs at the UW system schools. What did the panelists have to say about that deal?
So Patricia Brady, she talked a little bit about this, about how this is not the first time in history that we've definitely seen something like this, like a legislator kind of holding stuff back from a university in order to get them to do what they want. And I think this is where the part of where the university's accountability lies. And unfortunately, in this case, because they had like the engineering building and some pay raises from staff that the legislation was holding down, like holding back from the university, they unfortunately had to take part of the deal. And it kind of just goes to show how she talked a lot about how basically like the faculty need to be putting pressure on the university to choose things that are also like in interest of both them and the students and the overall well-being of the university. Because if we're always going to be stuck in these situations where the legislator is just going to hold something back from us to get us to do what they want us to do, it's just going to be a never-ending cycle. And then we're just going to be basically accountable to the legislator rather than to the students and the faculty that work here.
So based on what you said, it sounds like the school is kind of beholden to the whims of the legislatures that have the control over what funding goes to it. One of the panelists, Brittany Edmonds, mentioned a lack of trust in both parties, the legislature and the UW system. What were her chief complaints about trust?
Yeah, a lot of what she had to say had to do with some of the more like generic DEI initiatives that we see that are being done, like racial sensitivity training, DEI trainings, all these different trainings that are really boring and cost a lot of money. And sometimes they kind of suck too, depending on who's teaching the trainings. So a lot of the trust comes from the fact that these cost a lot of money and they're not always seeing the results that they want to see right away. And it makes people have like a lot of distrust in general about like where this money is going to and the outcome that we're expecting to see from them.
Like you said, there's sort of imperfections to DEI. Did they mention any sort of improvements that the university could make to those sorts of programs?
Yeah, the main one all the panelists kind of agreed on is communication. I think that if the university was a lot more transparent about what targets they're actually trying to reach and what each initiative is trying to do and who it's trying to benefit. Professor Edmonds talks about this a lot, and she basically was saying that if they're able to specify these targets, then there can be like a better navigation on like to how to better each individual target rather than saying like we're doing DEI. Even though what does DEI mean on campus and what does it look like for faculty? What does it look like for students? What does it look like in the classroom, outside the classroom, et cetera? So definitely communicating on what they want DEI to look like on all the different facets on campus.
So sort of a desire for transparency.
Yeah.
So moving on to the other side of things that they talked about, you mentioned it's about academic freedom and freedom of speech. And I wanted to ask, what is the difference between those two things?
Yeah, so academic freedom basically gives professors the right to kind of teach what they want to teach, not teach what they want to teach, but give them the freedom to kind of lead their own classrooms, lead their own research, give them the initiative just to be the leader in the classroom and in their areas of expertise. Whereas it's different from freedom of speech because it doesn't necessarily always give them the right to say what they want to say, however they want to say it. So it definitely does not protect them from kind of being outlandish in their classrooms. But academic freedom does give them the right to kind of lead their own curriculums in their classroom, that makes sense. But they can't just also say whatever they want to say at the same time.
Another thing that you talk about in that academic freedom section of your article is tenure. And I wanted to ask what the relationship is between tenure and academic freedom.
Yeah, so tenure is another protection under academic freedom. And basically, it helps keep professors from not losing their job for the type of research or stuff that they're teaching in their classroom. And it was almost like another barrier for them, once again, to make sure that wherever they are, whatever campus that they're on, that they can make sure that they're actually teaching the stuff that they spent years researching and learning about. And that's kind of the protection that tenure like is able to give them.
So in your article, you mentioned a current threat to tenure. What is that?
I believe in 2015, Governor Walker made like a really big budget cut and basically removed tenure, or removed the budget for tenure for faculty at UW-Madison. And basically ever since then, a lot of faculty have still been trying to organize to kind of get the money back for those things. And it has been rough. I mean, like a lot of faculty sometimes can't stay all the time and have to leave like the university because of recent actions like those. So yeah, it definitely like makes it hard for faculty to want to stay at a university where they're not sure if they're always like their research and the stuff that they learned about and want to teach in the classroom is always going to be protected.
So moving on to and thinking about outside the panel was put on by the UW-Madison Center for Humanities. What do they do on campus?
So the Center for Humanities basically hosts like a plethora of different panel discussions similar to the one I went to about various different topics throughout the academic school year. A lot of them are really interesting and they have different speakers both from the university and also like outside the university come and speak.
And one last question. Is there anything that you learned over the course of your reporting that stuck out to you?
I think I was really, really fascinated by the university independence part of it and kind of thinking about how UW-Madison is a public university, but are we really serving the interests of the public per se, or like the greater Madison community or the greater Wisconsin community? And Harry Brighaus touches on this. He touched on this during the panel, but he talks about how the university is supposed to be public, but yet we make it really expensive for people to go here and we make it really hard for people to get in. So are we really serving the people through the Wisconsin idea that like we're saying that we're supposed to serve? And a lot of it sometimes has to do with the fact that we do serve like private interests sometimes when the university is making decisions.
Well, that's all pretty interesting. Thanks for coming on this week, Amari. In seasonal campus news, the iconic orange, green, and yellow sunburst chairs have returned to Memorial Union's terrace for the warm months. The occasion was marked by a terrace opening party on April 18th. In other campus news, on April 17th, political commentator Ezra Klein discussed his book on American polarization called Why We're So Polarized. During the event, Klein went in depth on the divides behind the rise in polarization. Klein said during the event that America's founding fathers had misjudged the future political landscape by placing too much belief in the influence of regional identities. In sports news, two Wisconsin Badgers men's basketball starters, A.J. Storr and Chucky Hepburn, are leaving the Badgers. Storr entered the transfer portal on March 28th, and Hepburn followed as of April 18th. The Badgers have lost five other players to the portal this year and have no transfers currently coming into the program.
This has been the Cardinal Call, created by UW-Madison student journalists. Check out more news and stories at dailycardinal.com.
It's now 6:44 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
With the wide array of dining options all over Madison, it's good to know where you can go for both a special occasion or a casual meal out, and where you can get a fish fry on a Tuesday. Look no further than Turnkey Supper Club on East Washington Avenue, which opened in 2022 and rebranded to a supper club this past year. On this week's edition of Stuff Your Face, Feature contributor Emily Tucker heads to Turnkey to chat with their general manager, Reese Railing.
I'm here for our second edition of Stuff Your Face, joined by Reese Railing, the general manager at the Turnkey. Reese, I know you helped open this space and have helped transform it through the last couple of years. Can you tell me about the journey? How did we get here?
Well, it all started when Ryan, Brian, and Sam, the three owners of the place, they're old friends of mine, and they said, hey, we're going to be opening up a new space on the north side. But that kind of fell through a little bit just due to pandemic-related things. And lo and behold, the space at 1344 East Washington, where Pasquale's and Fife's Corner Bistro and the Washington Host used to be, became available. And we thought, wow, that is a great opportunity for a huge restaurant. I don't know if we can quite do that. And now we're a year and a half in on Turnkey Supper Club.
That's fantastic. I came here shortly after you all opened, and it was so obvious that you really nailed the vibe. And then I heard that more recently it has evolved into more of a supper club. I came here again, brought my parents, who are pretty much Wisconsin supper club experts. They loved it. You nailed the vibe again. So how does lightning strike twice in one place?
I guess some people are just lucky. Yeah, and I think it's just a lot of hard work and passion. All of us kind of grew up around supper clubs. We enjoyed them. You can wear a tuxedo or you can wear your flip-flops or you can wear a tuxedo with flip-flops. We'll take care of you.
As someone who used to wear my slippers to the bar in college, I really appreciate this is a place where people can show up as they are. That's what is so special about Turnkey is that you really feel welcome here no matter how you show up, and that's sort of rare. The first thing I had on the menu here at Turnkey was the rainbow trout with some sort of delicious white bean stew at the time. I'm just curious, who thinks up your recipes and how often do they change?
Some of the stuff has stayed on the menu nearly the entire time. You find some stuff and if you take it off the menu, the uproar is crazy. But we always kind of try to change with the season, with what's available. If somebody has a great idea, if somebody went on a trip and had something awesome, or if we meet a new producer, or our friends say at like Vitruvian Farms, or say, hey, check out this new yada yada that we have. And it's like, ooh, that's a fun challenge. Let's jump into that. Right now, our chef is Chris Sanchez. He moved here from California with his family not too long ago, and we're baptizing him into the world of supper clubs, just as we do ourselves.
So what is your favorite thing to stuff your face with here at Turnkey right now?
Ooh, my favorite thing to stuff my face with is probably the prime rib French dip sandwich. We cook prime rib every Saturday night for Saturday night prime rib dinner, and every Sunday we do prime rib and eggs for brunch. We also roast prime rib other days and then shave it real thin and make a French dip out of that. Some delicious bread from our friends at Stalzi's. Ooh, boy, that's a good one.
I know my favorite thing recently that I had here was the party time relish tray. Not only because I love a party time, but mostly because of the crispy pickled veg and the super thin chips. I will have to try the prime rib next time I come. Tonight is a Tuesday night. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you have fish fry on Tuesday nights and on Fridays. Can you tell me about that? That is really a gift to the community. So what inspired that?
What inspired that? It is a gift to the community, and it's a gift to especially our service industry friends who can never make it out for Friday night fish fry. It's a way to serve more people fish fry. I mean, we're packed on Friday nights a lot of times, so not everybody can get that fish fry right in the perfect time that they want it. And sometimes, you know, you just need to have to do it again on a Tuesday, and it seems to be working out real nice, and we can just pretend it's a Friday.
It seems like you're always thinking of new ways to have fun. Can you talk to me about Club Krusty?
Well, if it ain't fun, we don't do it. Club Krusty, the idea is that you can make any cocktail a shrimp cocktail. For $4, you can add one colossal shrimp to your drink. I mean, it could be a glass of Chardonnay, it could be a grasshopper, but most people are doing it in Bloody Marys or in like a Michelada or something like that. We got punch cards. Probably the biggest pull of Club Krusty is the punch card. And I look forward to the entire city of Madison, Dane County, state of Wisconsin, and the world to be part of Club Krusty. All are welcome.
Sounds like you are working to keep Madison weird just like WORT is, and we really appreciate that. Reese, what is your favorite thing about working in the food industry?
Oh, I just love the people and the eating and drinking.
And what do you think the most challenging thing is?
The people and eating and drinking.
Fair enough. Thanks so much for spending the time with me today to talk about Turnkey, and we wish you much success in the future.
Thank you.
It's duckling season, and those little ones can get into a lot of trouble. Feature contributor Jackie Sandberg lays out all the ways ducklings might end up needing help in tonight's Wildlife Weekly.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today we are talking about babies. More babies! Okay, we're talking about babies a lot, but we are very excited this week that we have more babies, and our baby shower was all last week, and we've talked about that, but we actually have our first baby ducklings of the year, so our first baby peeping mallards have come in. They are so cute, they're so adorable. I love the little fluffy ducks, they're just so fun. They are very messy, and they are very loud, and they definitely need their moms at this kind of stage. And we are about to probably see somewhere between 200 to 400 ducklings that are going to come through our program here just over the next couple of months. So it's very exciting for us when we have our first groups in, because we get to work with all of our wonderful volunteers. There's 150 people helping us day in and day out with our program. And we get to work with them to train them about how to work with ducks, how to really just feed them, clean them, take care of them, make sure they have water. We do full physical exams, medications, evaluations, and they need time to grow. So most of our ducklings have been admitted because they are sick, injured, or orphaned. And the ducklings that are admitted as orphans are usually split up somehow because mom is crossing a road, or maybe she is walking down a street and a storm sewer drain opening is just big enough for those little ducklings to fall through. And so she might walk over and her little clutch of ducklings is behind her, and one by one they drop through the storm sewer grate. Or we have a lot of ducks that will nest on top of buildings, sometimes even on top of people's pools in their backyard. Or they might find a backyard pond that might be in a really heavily urban area. So sometimes we see ducks that'll nest near or around a fountain that might be in like the middle of a mall space or some sort of, you know, outdoor pavilion. Those are situations where sometimes, while it's great that they have access to water, it doesn't mean that they always have access to the food that they need. So when I think about our tiny ducklings, I think, okay, do they have water? Are they able to safely get to water? And sometimes mom will nest a couple miles away and walk her babies all the way to wherever she wants to access water. But they also need food. And mallards are dabbling ducks, and a lot of their protein sources are going to come from duckweed, which is naturally growing in the water. We might have things like, you know, grass. You see geese kind of nibbling around in the grass all the time. Maybe they're merganser babies and wood ducks that might need more insect matter. Mergansers maybe are eating fish. So we have so many different ducklings of different waterfowl species that we will take care of at the Wildlife Center. And so we have to know exactly how to feed them, care for them. And if they are stuck or trapped in an area where they don't really have access to good food, hopefully either mom can find a way to get them to another location, or she is going to attempt it herself. And that's where we get into issues where ducks are crossing traffic. Maybe they're stuck in a courtyard in a building. Maybe they are on top of a building and they are jumping from the top of the building down to the floor. Maybe it's six stories. You know, that's a situation where you could have injured ducklings. You could have them separated. So you might find a number of orphaned ducklings just wandering around alone. Those are the situations where we would recommend having those ducklings brought in for rehabilitation. So if they don't have mom around, we're going to do our best to be able to give them a safe place to live and recover and hopefully grow into the point where they have all of their feathers in. So as rehabilitators, we tend to make sure that our ducks before release, they have to have all of their chest feathers in that are waterproof. Our little ducklings really start off as little hatchlings with natal down, and that down is really fluffy and fuzzy, but it's not waterproof. It's more for insulation. It's supposed to keep them warm. The feather structure actually is open and airy so that it traps more air underneath the feathers, and that will keep it insulated next to the skin and the body as they're growing. And Mom would usually sit on them, or they would run underneath of Mom, so she kind of like scoops them up under her feathers or her wings and under her belly. And that's going to keep them really warm at night. So we have to offer them external heat sources. We use little brooder shelves that have external heat that you might use for raising chickens, for example. We use heat lamps. We want to make sure that they have access to food, water, heat support, and then also be able to offer them swimming environments once they get a little bit older. So once our ducks are a little bit older, they will be going out into different enclosures where they'll have access to swimming water. So the swimming ponds are fun for the ducks because they love to practice swimming and drinking and eating. And then they graduate eventually to really large stock tanks that are 1,000-gallon ponds for them. And so that they're able to really access as much as the natural environment as they possibly can before they can be released back to a site that is great for ducks, which in the Madison area, of course, we're surrounded by lakes, so there are a lot of great spots to be able to release ducks. And we're always looking for lakefront property owners to potentially be a release site for us. We certainly will release on the different lakes, and sometimes we have permissions for some of the public water access sites. But maybe there is a nice spot with a lot of duckweed and some, you know, beautiful vegetation. You can always check out our website for our release site application and fill that out. Or you can go online and print it out and you could send it in, mail it in to us, or you can always think about emailing us any information as well. If you do need our email address at any time with a wildlife question, our email address is wildlife@giveshelter.org. And if you check on our website for information about what to do in your situation, whether it's about ducks you find or that release site application or anything like that, our website is www.giveshelter.org. So that's been our segment today, talking about the first of our baby ducklings that are going to be out and about, hatching everywhere, and getting into perilous situations. So please be on the lookout for orphan ducklings. We are available to help with appointments from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day, and we will hopefully be able to call back to answer your advice if you leave us a voicemail. Give us a call at 608-287-3235. Thanks for listening here on WORT. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Greg Sanderson.
Your reporters were Lila Grubb and Ella Saff. And special thanks to feature contributors Jackie Sandberg, Emily Tucker, and Oliver Gerhartz.
Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Nate Carlin produced this newscast.
And Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. And subscribe wherever you keep up with podcasts.
And I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Up next is Spanish Language News with Nuestro Patio. Good night.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings.
Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
And this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Up next, in Nuestro Patio.
A Nuestro Patio, un espacio en Word para la comunidad latina.
Panamá,
presente.
Puerto Rico,
presente.
México,
presente.
Venezuela,
presente.
Perú,
presente.
República Dominicana,
presente.
Cuba,
presente.
Costa Rica,
presente.
Hola, hola, muy buenas tardes y bienvenidos a una edición más de Nuestro Patio, el programa en español de WORT 89.9 FM, la radio comunitaria. Hoy, martes 23 de abril del 2024, 7 de la tarde, 7 con 1. La temperatura ya está enfriando un poquito, pero la verdad es que estuvo bastante rico el clima el día de hoy. Aún estamos a 16 grados centígrados, una sensación térmica de 15. Eso, si ustedes piensan en Fahrenheit, en el sistema imperial, esto sería 60 Fahrenheit con una sensación térmica de 57. Está rico el clima. De hecho, no hace tanto aire como creí que haría en la tarde. Y nada, hoy les tenemos noticias de Democracy Now!, tenemos noticias locales, cortesía de nuestra colaboradora Zoe. Y tengo música, de hecho tengo un par de dedicatorias de música. Si ustedes quieren dedicar música, mándenos un mensajito, bueno no, háblenos y déjenos un mensajito, 608-256-2001. Pueden hablar con Michelle, nuestra recepcionista, o si les da pena, que de hecho prefiero que hablen con